Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Who are we? Where did we come from? And why are we here? Yes, this week on Science Mixtape, we're looking at some fundamental questions about our very own humanity. Joining me is Mark Dybel from the Human Evolution Ecology Group at UCL. Mark is an evolutionary anthropologist who specialised in studying modern hunter-gatherers and spent last year living with the Agtar Group in the Philippines. Good morning, Mark. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Now, before we get going, as I understand it, anthropology is the study of humanity, and that can be broken down into lots of different areas like social and biological, and you're an evolutionary anthropologist. So what exactly is that?
Yeah, so as you said, anthropology is a broad church. Within that, I'm an evolutionary anthropologist, and so that's evolution not only just in the sense of change through time, but change through Darwinian natural selection. And so evolutionary anthropologists are interested in two things, really. The first one is how our evolutionary heritage has, how it continues to shape modern behaviour, but also our evolutionary story of how we, you know, what makes us unique, what makes us different from the non-human apes and stuff like that.
Oh, exciting. And one other thing that I just wanted to clarify was, so when I think of a hunter-gatherer, I think of, you know, cave-dwelling, killing mammoth people. And I was actually kind of really surprised to learn that we still have hunter-gatherers in the modern world. So what is a modern hunter-gatherer?
Well, that's a very good question, actually. We study modern hunter-gatherers as to provide some insight into hunter-gatherers in the past. But modern hunter-gatherers are increasingly involved with farming neighbours and so on. But we define hunter-gatherers, modern hunter-gatherers, as people who primarily subsist through hunting and gathering, as the name suggests.
But not mammoths.
No.
Great. So stay tuned to hear more about Mark's research on food sharing and sexual equality later in the show. But right now, we have got, of course, our weekly science experiment. And this week is an anthropology-based one. So we've actually done a survey ahead of the show, how organised of us, asking a few questions looking at social networks. This will become clear why later. So if you want to do our full survey, it's only six questions. You can head right now to our Twitter at Soho Radio, and we have tweeted a link. Or you can just take part in one of the questions. I want you to think, if you saw someone that you knew in the street, think of all the people you know, roughly how many would you actually go up to them and say hi and have a chat? So what is that number? How many people would you say hi to if you saw them in the street? And again, just tweet us in at Soho Radio. All right, let's get on with the music. So Mark, you've picked all the songs today. This is your mixtape. And what are we starting with?
We're going to start with a song which I really feel addresses the fundamental question of anthropology, which is, what about us? And this is by The Saturdays featuring Sean Paul. Whatever the weather, we gonna be better together. So what's up, baby? What about us? Ready for your giving his love, my girl. Cause I've been watching and waiting. Why don't you give in and take it? So what's up, baby? What about us? What you doing?
News. This week was basically the Oscars of the science world, because we had the Nobel Prizes being awarded. Woohoo, super exciting. So very briefly, obviously we can't have science news without talking about what those were. The Nobel Prize awarded for medicine was awarded to three people for their novel therapies against infectious diseases caused by parasites. So one was William Campbell of Drew University and Satoshi Imura of Kitasato University. And they were particularly looking at infections caused by roundworm parasites. And then the other person was Yu Yu Tu from China's Academy of Traditional Chinese Medicine for her discovery of a novel therapy against malaria. I think this one is so cool because actually, what she did was she and her team trawled through ancient Chinese remedies on how to fight malaria. And they found a script written 1,600 years ago entitled Emergency Prescriptions to Kept Up One's Sleeve. And it talked about a cure made from sweet wormwood, which was prepared in water to treat the disease, but it only worked sometimes. It wasn't 100% effective. And she actually traced the problem back to the way that you prepared it with water was they often boiled it, and this destroyed the active ingredients in the sweet wormwood. So she then prepared it at a lower temperature and tested it on monkeys and mice, and it was 100% effective. And they started using it on people in 1972, and it's proved to be an incredible treatment. So yeah, also super exciting because she's only the 12th woman in 210 Nobel laureates in medicine to win an award. So that's really exciting.
She's also the first Chinese person to win a Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I know. It's like finally acknowledging the advances in Chinese science. So that's a big one as well. So all the excitement in the world of the medicine and physiology Nobel Prize. Kyle, being a physicist, I'm going to ask you to explain the Physics Nobel Prize.
Yeah, so the Physics Nobel Prize is was awarded to Takaaki Kajita and Arthur MacDonald for their discovery of neutrino oscillations. And so what neutrino oscillation is it's one of the fundamental particles that exist in nature. It's called neutrino, and neutrino means small and neutral. And the problem with it is that it doesn't interact with anything. So it was discovered way back in the 1930s, where it appeared like this missing momentum in all these high energy interactions. Something was happening. There was something missing. Nobody knew what it was. And they proposed this thing called a little neutrino. And since then, they've been really hard to detect. And recently, they were looking at the neutrinos that came from the sun, and they realized that there was much, much less of them than they would have expected. Mm. So you get neutrinos from like the interaction in the sun. And what both both Kajita and MacDonald did was to build these massive experiments which detect these neutrinos.
Yeah, they were like deep underground, weren't they?
Yeah, so their experiments are like these big vats of liquid, usually built hundreds of feet underground in mines, because you need a lot of stuff to detect these tiny little particles. And they come in, these particles come in kind of different flavors. And what happens is, as these neutrinos are coming from the sun, they start as one flavor and then they change to another, or they oscillate backwards and forwards.
So just to be clear, when we're talking about flavors, we're not talking about like the taste of the particle.
No. You wouldn't be able to taste these. They don't interact enough for you to taste them.
It's just like a mathematical term that they have one flavor or another. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah. Different types, basically. And, you know, physicists run out of words for these weird concepts. So we choose one that, you know, flavor. Hey,
like electrons having a spin.
Exactly. What happens is these neutrinos oscillate between one type and another, and it's these kind of oscillations that explain why we don't see as many neutrinos as we would have expected from the sun. And so this kind of, these big experiments that both these guys built, one called the Super Kamioka in Japan and the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory in the United States, and they built these massive things and detected these oscillations, which is why they got the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even get my head around that. They're meant to be the second most abundant particle in the world, universe, after photons.
Yeah, so there's you know, billions of them passing through your body all the time. But because they're so small and they don't interact with anything, you just never see them.
Yeah, no idea. Wow. And then the third was the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. And this was awarded to three scientists for uncovering how cells repair DNA damage. So DNA, sort of that fundamental building block at the center of every cell that contains all the information to make the organism. And it gets damaged through a lot of different ways. And so the first person, Thomas Lindau, he was awarded it because he basically created a whole new field of research when he realizes there were certain mechanisms within a cell whose sole purpose was to repair the fragile DNA parts and repair them when they got damaged. Then you have Aziz Sankar from the University of North Carolina. And she figured out that UV light, so light coming from our sun, actually does a lot of damage. It's one of the most common ways or easiest ways to damage DNA. And so she figured that out, and also the ways in which the cells repair that. That's why everyone tells you to wear sunblock, because UV light is damaging your skin and the DNA within it. And then the third person was Paul Modrick from Duke University, and he found some cellular repair kits that fix DNA when it's been sort of mistakenly copied as we replicate our cells. So the three of them got it for jointly uncovering the toolbox of our cells and how it fixes the DNA. And there you have it. The Nobel Prizes, digested for you on Science Mixtape. But Mark, you found some exciting science news this week, all about Lazy Ants. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think it's going to win the Nobel Prize anytime soon, but it was quite caught my eye. So basically, a team of researchers at the University of Arizona, they have ant colonies in the lab. And so people have known for a long time that, you know, within ant colonies, there are workers who specialize in different tasks. Some of them go and get food, some of them look after the brood, some of them build the nest and so on. So what they did was, I think they basically just painted different ants with different kind of patterns.
I'm just like picturing Elmo, but in ant form.
and they filmed them for 5 minutes every hour for 2 weeks or something like that, to see, I wonder which guys are going to be doing the foraging, which guys are going to be building the nest.
Yeah, did they all do the same job?
Exactly, yeah. Is there a division of labour? And it turns out there kind of is a division of labour, insofar as about 3% of them work all the time and about 25% of them do absolutely nothing.
What?
And the remainder do almost next to nothing.
Oh my god, 3%. Exactly. Carrying the population on their backs.
Yeah, I think it's attracted a lot of interest because people have been like, oh, exactly like human society. You know, some guys do all the work and some do nothing.
But, and the concept we have of ants is like they're busy all the time, you know, industrious, hardworking ants, like all of them, not 3% of them.
Exactly. So it's, I thought I'd pick it because it's a good, it's not the answer to a problem, it's a big interesting problem and question in itself.
Yeah. Do they have any ideas why they think this might be?
Well, one possibility I think is that ants are quite cheap both to make and to maintain, right? So unlike humans, you need to eat a lot just to, you know, if you sit on the sofa all day doing nothing, you still need to.
Yeah, you still burn a lot of calories.
Exactly.
And need to keep eating.
But if you're just, you know, these little guys don't really need any energy just to sustain themselves. They're, you know, they're not warm-blooded or anything like that.
My favourite fact, ants only need to sleep 8 minutes twice a day.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not that they do much the rest of the time. Maybe they're not very tired. So maybe it's just that if they're so cheap to produce and maintain, you may as well just have a load more ants kind of sitting on the bench doing nothing. And then if something big happens, like something falls into the nest, you can mobilize these guys to build it. But that's just a hypothesis. No one's really sure why they're so lazy.
One other theory that I saw was maybe like some of them were too old or too young to work. But I don't know how you would measure ants' ages.
Yeah, no idea.
Super interesting, though. And we'll be talking more about social cooperation in humans later in the show. So stay tuned for that. Another news article that caught my eye, mainly because I saw it and I was like, David Cameron probably wants one of those, was that Beijing Genomics Institute, so again, more science from China, are creating tiny pigs using a new genetic editing technique called TALENs. So they basically, the world of test tube babies isn't upon us, but test tube micro pigs is. And they originally developed these pigs as part of a stem cell project. And they're now selling them £1,000 each to raise money for the institute. And customers can decide what colour they want their animal's coat and the coat pattern, because they can manipulate it using this TALENs genetic makeup. So really controversial in the kind of animal welfare world. The idea, you know, the head of research at RSPCA was like, oh, inducing such a massive change in one go is going to cause these animals horrific suffering. And we should move away from the idea that we can, you know, make our companions cute and a small size, and you know, we shouldn't be trying to modify them. And then other people have argued, well, actually throughout our history we've been selectively breeding animals, and you look at, you know, the bulldog and all their problems, and pugs' faces are so flat they have problems breathing, and maybe actually this genetic modification will be a more humane way. So all to play for in the debate of whether we should have test tube pigs. And what was the other one that caught your eye?
The other one was a study using ancient DNA. So obviously, you know, living organisms, you can extract their DNA and take a look. But in the last 10 years or so, there's really been a boom in this industry of extracting DNA from fossils, which is quite difficult, especially in warm climates. So it kind of works well, you know, if you find some bones in a Siberian cave, the chances are some of the DNA will be preserved. But because DNA isn't preserved so well in hotter places, in Africa, for example, mm-hmm. there's been a paucity of ancient DNA evidence from African populations until this week, when a very interesting one came out. They found it's in the Ethiopian highlands, which is obviously much cooler than, because it's at altitude and so on, and they basically, what they found is clear evidence of a dispersal from Eurasia into Africa 5 to 10,000 years ago, which isn't really that surprising that populations should come and go and so on. But generally, it's another kind of complication in this out of Africa, you know, the hypothesis that humans originated in Africa and then expanded.
That's our birthplace, and then we've sort of migrated to the rest of the world.
Exactly. But increasingly, that well, that is still the main part of the story, but there are lots of extras of populations coming and going and admixture with Neanderthals and so on. And so this is kind of, yeah, suggesting that as well as out of Africa, it was kind of out of Africa, then back, and then out, and back, and out, and so on.
Bit more cyclical then.
Yeah.
Cool. So we thought it, and it's been kind of shown to be true.
Yeah.
My favourite fact from this story was that they, I did not know that the inner ear bone preserves DNA better than most bones. So that's the one they used to analyse the DNA from in his skeleton.
Yeah, that was a surprise.
Yeah. So your ears, really important for the future, guys. Yeah. Well, that is quite enough science news for one show. So what song are we going to have next, Mark?
Well, going back to big questions in anthropology, one question is, are there any human universals? And from my time in the field, I think that so the people I studied in the Philippines, they love this song. So I'm going to put this down as a human universal, which is a love of the song Waka Waka by Shakira.
Brilliant.
You're on the front line, everyone's watching. You know it's serious, we're getting closer, this isn't over. The pressure's off, you feel it, but you got it all, believe it. When you fold it up, oh, oh, and if you fold it up, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sangalewa, cause this is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh, waka, waka, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sangalewa, this time for Africa.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Science Mixtape. And contrary to what that song might suggest, we're not going to be talking about Africa. We're going to be talking about the Philippines, which is where Mark spent 8 months with the ACTA tribe, ACTA group.
ACTA, yeah.
ACTA tribe.
Quote unquote tribe.
Quote unquote, yeah. Cool. So tell us, why? Why were you out there? Why were you living with them? And
well, I'm actually one part of a much bigger project in which there are PhD students and researchers from UCL who are studying hunter-gatherer populations around the world. And we wanted to get as much of a kind of comparative sample as possible. So there's some people working in Congo, both Republic of Congo and the DRC, some people working in Thailand, Malaysia, and myself and a couple of others in the Philippines. And these guys are quite interesting because unlike, so we kind of imagine hunter-gatherers as being terrestrial hunter-gatherers. So, you know, out on the savannah hunting deer or whatever.
Yeah.
But my guys were actually, I suppose you could describe them as fisher foragers in as much as they do much more fishing than hunting. And they go spearfishing in rivers and so on and collecting octopus and mollusks and
cool.
The coastline and stuff.
Did you eat some octopus?
Yeah. And lobsters as well. It was a hard life eating little lobsters and all sorts of things like that. And actually the best thing is honey from the forest.
Oh, wow.
Fresh
wow,
honey. And they climb the trees and they smoke out the bees. So bees don't like smoke. And they sometimes they have to climb, I don't know, 20 meter high trees. It's incredible. I gave a GoPro to one of the guys once, and I got some footage of him climbing the tree and looking at the bees and stuff.
Oh, that's so
which
cool.
Which is nice. Maybe I can post a link.
Yeah, that's
that.
Great. We'll put it on Twitter.
And so were you living with them or you just kind of would visit them?
So I was living with them. So we lived in an area, there were maybe 20 different communities, which were more or less 1 or 2 hours apart each. And people, these are very fluid communities, households move regularly between communities just to visit people or to take advantage of like seasonal foraging opportunities and so on. But we kind of went around and spent at least a week or two in most of those communities. So we kind of toured around.
Cool.
And kind of, so we had tents and kind of
and do they
pitched.
Live in tents as well?
They make temporary structures out of wood. And so,
And how often would they actually kind of move around?
So they move on average every 10 days.
Gosh, that's not really much time to nest in each place.
No. So you don't want many possessions if you're moving around regularly. Mm. And you don't necessarily need that many when you're a hunter-gatherer as well. It depends on the season as well.
And how was like the language barrier? Was how did you guys communicate?
We had translators to begin with, and by the end, I kind of had enough basic language to kind of...
Oh, brilliant.
Kind of
can you remember any of it?
Not that much now. don't make me do it. We were working through translators for most of...
And what exactly were you kind of looking for when you were living with them?
So I myself was looking at the hunting and gathering of these hunter-gatherers. I was looking at food production. So I was weighing all food which came into camp so I could see, you know, who's producing what kinds of foods, how efficient are different people per hour getting different things, and then what do they do with that food once they bring it back into camp? So how do they share it between different households? What's the process by which people share? So it's kind of about cooperation.
So in my head, I would imagine, is it family basic? You've got your family and they kind of get food for themselves, or do they share amongst the whole group? How big are their groups?
So groups are on average 20 adults, which is so like four or five households. Households do tend to be kind of, again, quote unquote, nuclear families. But they do a lot of sharing, particularly of the bigger resources. So plant resources, which you can maybe each household could go out and almost certainly get something, almost certainly bring something back. Then those small resources, they don't necessarily share that much. But with bigger things, if you get a huge haul of honey or a pig or something, then that is shared widely.
Oh, that's so nice.
Between everyone in the camp.
Would they sort of like eat it straight away and all kind of like have a big feast, or is just literally like, here, this is your portion, eat it when you want?
Yeah, well, actually, sometimes they would share after they've cooked it, so they would, yeah, kind of have a bit of a feast, especially honey. Honey just
goes.
Just goes.
Yeah. And were there, so you were saying you were like weighing the food coming in, were there surprising differences, or was everyone fairly equal in their contribution to the group?
There were some people who were just, there was one guy I remember in one of the coastal communities who was just like a superman, who would just bring in like 10 kilos of fish every day.
Oh, wow. You'd want to live in his group.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. But, people didn't feel bad about the fact that he was producing more. They were just like, well, that's the guy who loves fishing. That's all he wants to do.
Great. And so you were talking earlier about kind of these ants and the lazy ant hypothesis. And what's quite interesting, I guess, about looking at hunter-gatherers, and you were saying food sharing things, is it the same idea? Do you have division of labour?
Yes, you do, yeah. And actually, the ants is quite an interesting thing, because we kind of talk about how hunter-gatherers avoid the free rider problem, which is that if everyone is sharing, particularly, as I said, the kind of bigger resources, how do you stop people being lazy free riders and not foraging anything, but then eating what other people
eating
returned?
The spoils.
Exactly. So how do they maintain that kind of system of cooperation and so on? That's one of the things I was looking at.
And did you find any answers?
As always, the answers are kind of a bit of everything. Yeah, there's different, you know. Oh, actually, one important thing is the high mobility, which we mentioned earlier. So basically, if a camp is full of free riders, you just move on somewhere else.
If you're bringing in food, you just move to a camp where there's no free riders.
Yeah, exactly. And in other populations, studies have sort of shown that the high producers tend to cluster together. So eventually the free riders, you know, are going to have to do some
work, because they'll have lost all the other people.
Yeah, so that's one of the main mechanisms.
And what else were you looking at?
So I was looking at social organisation and sex equality and things like this. As I said earlier, they live in camps, but they also live in households and extended families. So they kind of have different layers to their social networks.
Exciting. Right. So it's coming to 5:30. We're going to be looking more at social networks and sexual equality. It's actually really fascinating. So stay tuned. I'm really excited to talk about this after our 3-minute science, which is our regular feature from Kyle. Kyle's in the studio with us today. So I'm going to let Kyle introduce it himself.
Hi. Hiya. So I've interviewed Guy Berdiak in Imperial College, and he blows things up for a living and tries to study kind of plasma physics and stuff. But I don't know that much about it, so I'll let him try and describe what he does in 3 minutes.
Brilliant.
3 minute science.
3 minute science.
Firing.
I'm Guy Berdiak. I'm a postdoc
with the plasma physics group at Imperial College, and I work on a pulse power machine called the MAGPI generator.
So what's MAGPI?
MAGPI is an acronym for Mega Ampere Generator for Plasma Implosion Experiments.
What does that mean?
Basically, it's a big electrical generator, a lightning generator, I guess. We use it to vaporize small amounts of material using electricity to generate plasmas and study their behavior.
And can you describe what it is you do without using the word plasma, the word laser, or the word ionization?
We study the physics of very hot stuff. The kind of stuff that's found in, say, the middle of the sun. It's so hot it emits light in the form of X-rays. So this stuff has some very interesting properties. It interacts with magnetic fields in very interesting ways.
Why would it be important? Why would we want to react to plasma within a magnetic field?
Well, there are a couple of sort of broad lines to our research. One of them we call laboratory astrophysics. So here what we're trying to do is get a greater understanding of a lot of the dramatic dynamic events that occur in space. So, for example, supernova explosions or the interaction of jets of plasma emanating from the centres of black holes, for example, with the interstellar medium. It's difficult to understand the physics governing the interactions between charged gases and magnetic fields by looking at objects in space, because they're very far away and they evolve over many human lifetimes. So what we try and do in the lab is scale down versions of things that are happening in space so that we can do a controlled experiment, diagnose it very thoroughly, and repeat the experiment every day.
What's the most important outcome for this kind of research?
Well, I mean, a lot of people come into plasma physics because they want to study nuclear fusion. They want to get nuclear fusion to work as a viable commercial energy source for humans of the future. So this is the energy source that powers the sun. Although we cannot do nuclear fusion in our lab because our machine is not big enough to do this, fusion experiments on a similar, much larger machine in the United States are happening. What we can do on our smaller machine is study some of the physics that are relevant to fusion physics, but not actually do fusion itself.
Yeah, so how long will it be before I get my Iron Man suit?
50 years!
3 minute science.
3 minute science.
Stanza, guardi le stelle che tremano.
so incredibly epic. That was Nessun Dorma from an opera by Puccini. Mark, why did you choose that one this morning?
Because, I mean, I don't speak Italian, but I'm told that Nessun Dorma means none shall sleep, which I thought was appropriate for a Saturday morning.
Absolutely. That would rouse anyone. Fantastic. Well, we are back and we are now going to be talking about your really exciting research into the fact that these hunter-gatherer groups seem to have sexual equality. So we're talking ancient feminism going on. Yeah, if I've just bastardized that, I'm really sorry.
No.
Tell me more.
I think that's kind of the gist.
I think that's incredibly exciting because we've always thought that sort of there's been male dominance forever. And you look at chimpanzee groups and other kind of primate groups and they all seem to be kind of, you know, have one male, like silverback, kind of the hierarchy is always in the males and lots of females gathered around them. So yeah, when you told me this and I just thought that was so incredibly interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a big if, which is that if modern hunter-gatherers are a good model for humans in human evolutionary history, which hopefully they by and large are, then it suggests that, yeah, perhaps there has been this transition, as you say, from a kind of male hierarchies and male chimpanzees all living together to a more fluid social organisation where there's relative sex equality. And also political equality as well. Small scale hunter gatherers, it's not only equality between sexes, but they don't tend to have leaders emerge or any kind of social hierarchy.
So, how do they live together? So, when you're talking about sexual equality, let's just unpack that here. So, you're saying there's sexual equality of division of labour and of who kind of decides where they're living and what they're doing type of thing?
Yeah, so I mean, just quickly on the sexual division of labour sort of thing, it's not that they're necessarily doing the same things, but there is specialisation, but they kind of have mechanisms by which no one can really take the credit or for the production or whatever. But I was interested in, I mean, people have been talking about sex equality in hunter-gatherers for a long time. What I was looking at in particular is how that affects their social organisation, because another thing people have noticed for some time is that hunter-gatherers live, you kind of expect small-scale societies containing only, in communities of only 20 adults, you'd expect them to be perhaps one big extended family.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to be the case. A lot of people are completely unrelated to each other who are living together. So I wanted to know why that was the case. And my hypothesis is that it's something to do with sex equality, essentially because, I did some modelling, computer simulations and such, and about how you put a camp together, how you create a community. And I found that even if all individuals, men and women, if they all have equal influence over where they live, so within each household, both the man and the woman can have equal influence over deciding to move. And if they all want, if all individuals want to live with as many family members as possible, then somehow at the group level, no one ends up living with that many family at all.
So if you come from there's four kids and you will want to live with someone, but you also want to move camp, then you probably end up being two and two or something.
Exactly, yeah. So the sex equality and residential decision making breaks up these sibling sets so that you can't maintain a kind of
one cohesive family
exactly.
group.
Yeah.
And so how do they decide who they're going to live with?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, as we said earlier, they move every 10 days. So they don't really, I mean, any decision they make is only a short-term, temporary thing.
Oh, really? So actually, within the group of 20, you might then, next week be with a different group of 20 adults.
Exactly, yeah. The mobility is not of communities moving. It's not like everyone packs up and leaves together and goes somewhere else. There are places where there are always communities living, and the households are the mobile units. So they're the ones who think, okay, let's go and live with your family this week, or let's, go and visit so-and-so in the next valley or whatever.
Oh, great. So because that's another thing you said, was that you then get these really extended networks across the different communities because you've split the family up, but it then holds, you then have ties in a lot of different places.
Exactly, yeah. So I think that the big transition in human evolution in terms of our social organisation is from... So if we think about these hunter-gatherers, they're living in a small fixed group, in other words, a household.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got fixed membership. But their wider community is much more fluid, people moving and coming and going. Chimpanzees are the opposite. Okay, they live in a fixed community of maybe 50, 100 individuals, but they're always found in smaller subgroups. which means that they can never really, so male chimpanzees will never meet more than, I think a study showed recently, they never meet more than 40 or 50 other adult males in their entire life.
Wow.
Whereas if you're a hunter-gatherer, you are meeting hundreds and hundreds of people. And so the potential for therefore exchanging information, and therefore, yeah, language and tech, like the emergence of cumulative culture evolution and exchanging ideas about technology and so on, that's when that stuff can really take off. Which is why we think this, you know, sex equality in residential decision making creates a social structure which can explain why we do all these amazing things like language and culture and technology.
That's so cool. So when you were there, did you learn any new technologies, would you say?
I think I learned that I'm pretty useless. I would be pretty useless at surviving.
You didn't learn how to catch a lobster or climb a tree?
I caught one fish on spearfishing and then retired with a 100% record. I got lucky first time, basically.
You're like, I can fish, done. Yeah. Proved my worth. Yep. So do you have any ideas of why this, what sounds like a really great system, would have stopped, and why we did get the emergence of kind of male dominated societies?
Well, I mean a potential hypothesis is, well, what I think is quite a compelling one is, once you have agriculture, you're tied to the land, and once you have land, you have something to inherit.
So you can't move. Yeah.
So you can't move. It's when people settle down, and that also means that people can't move away from bullies, or, you know, they can't move away from free riders and so on, and that's when leadership emerges. I'm not saying, well, yeah, okay, leaders are kind of bullies, right, in some way. so I think sedentism and agriculture is the key.
So blame the farmers, basically. Blame the farmers. That's when we had men with many wives and many crops.
Yeah.
Hoarding their right to the land. I guess, yeah, if you're moving and no one owns a bit of land, then you don't have that kind of acquisition of wealth. Yeah. Fascinating. That is so cool. Well, we need to squeeze in another song. So what would you like next?
Ah, yes. So I thought talking about this social organisation and how to stop free riders and maintain cooperation in the group, one of the key mechanisms is, maybe was hypothesized to be, gossip and rumor. So I thought I would choose,
if you gossip about the lazy people, like, don't go work with him. Don't let him in your group.
Exactly.
So you thought you'd choose what, sorry?
Rumor Mill by Rudimental.
We introduced that by saying that one of the ways to get rid of free riders was with gossip. And this was a hypothesis by a great scientist called Dunbar. And he had another exciting hypothesis, which is why we've been asking you to send us in your answer to the question, how many people would you say hi to if you saw them on the street, looking at social networks? And what he thought was the maximum number of friends that you could maintain. So, I mean, this isn't my area, this is yours, Marks. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this hypothesis?
Sure, yeah. So, well, just quickly, it originated from Robin Dunbar was doing research on primates and looking at how big their groups were and how big their brains were, and found a really, really tight correlation between brain size and group size in primates, suggesting that there's some kind of cognitive constraint on, you need a big brain to think about and maintain all those
social interactions.
Exactly. So, and so from that, he said, okay, well, if I plug in human brain size, what would I expect the
number the group size to be?
So there is a number. We'll see if our survey matches it, but
so we've got the results. Kyle,
so we asked people, how many people would you say hi to if you saw them on the street? And so there's little bit of a spread of responses, but it seems like most people say that they would say hi to about 100 to 200 people in the street. So we get 30% of people responded say that they reply to 100 or 200, which is kind of in the region of what Dunbar found, right?
Yeah, it's in the right ballpark.
Oh, great. Wait, yeah. So what is Dunbar's number?
So Dunbar's number is 150. So, yeah, I mean, that kind of matches what we've got.
Yeah, and this is an average because, well, something I read about Dunbar's number said that sort of less social people would be more at the 100 and the slightly more social people would have maybe up to 200. Maybe, you know, they can really manage all their social interactions. So I'd say, cool, majority rules. We're kind of on track. And he found evidence for this number across sort of a lot of different like historical and anthropological records, didn't he?
He did, yeah. Although it's kind of one of those things that if you've got a particular number you're looking for, yeah, you can kind of scour the literature until you find something that matches your hypothesis. But yeah, but it does seem that there are constraints on it. And there are some nice examples. I think my favourite one is the size of a Roman...
Yeah.
I don't want to say legion, I want to say...
Company size in professional armies is close to 150. And that was the Roman army, the 16th century Spanish army, the Soviet Union. So that's, you know, pretty consistent.
So the idea is that we have a multi-level sociality. So there's 150 is our maybe maximum limit of people we can really kind of keep on top of our relationship with them. But within that, you kind of have maybe... a group of 50 people who you're interacting with more regularly. Within that, there's another group of, I don't know, 15 to 20, and then a very, very close group of around 5 people right in the middle. So you've got a lot of options to choose from.
Yeah, and that it would scale up to sort of acquaintances of about 500, I think he said, people that you knew. And didn't he also do like a Christmas card study, which showed that, like, he looked at Christmas cards sent in the UK, and in general, it seemed that individuals were sending these Christmas cards to a network of approximately 150, which is kind of friends, family, and work colleagues.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And so we've actually found that in our survey. So we also asked people, how many friends would you invite to a big party? And most people have said 50 to 100. So nearly half of the respondents have said 50 to 100. So that's people that as well as saying hi to in the street, they'd also invite to a big party.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, and so we had a couple other questions to try and elicit these smaller numbers that Dunbar suggested. So he said that you would have kind of 50 closer friends that you would see much more regularly. And to try and elicit that, we asked, how many people have you messaged, like texting or WhatsApping, in the last month?
Yeah, so we asked, in the last month, roughly how many people have you texted / WhatsApped? And most of our respondents, in fact, 50% said 15 to 30. So that's about the right number, I think.
Yeah, maybe slightly lower. But interestingly, I made someone at work do this quiz. And so I was with her when she was answering the questions. And she was like, oh, I haven't messaged that many people. Yeah, put me down as like 10. And I said, get your phone, look through your phone, and then tell me. And it went up to like, okay, maybe 45. So I wonder, with that question, if people have just like not done it properly and actually checked on their phone, whether they are unaware of how many people they're messaging. Because like, I did it myself. And okay, it's slightly skewed because sometimes you have like groups on WhatsApp, and I wasn't quite sure what to do that. Do I include everyone in the group? But yeah, it was like up around sort of 55, 60.
Actually, the size of groups on WhatsApp would be quite a nice one. If, you know, a group of friends has a WhatsApp group, how many people are active participants in that? That's a good idea. We'll do that.
And okay, so we had two more questions to elicit what we were hoping were the closer friends and then the most intimate of friends. So Kyle, would you tell us those?
Yeah, so we've got a couple of questions. One was, how many people would you feel comfortable going to for relationship advice? And for that, our respondents, again, nearly 60% of people said that there was only 6 to 15 people that they'd feel comfortable going to for relationship advice.
That's bang on Dunbar's number.
Yep, that works.
Yeah. Yay!
And then we tried to go even more intimate, which was, how many people could you cry to?
This one has had the most responses in terms of people like telling me, God, your survey's dark. That got dark quickly.
It did. But here, so again, over 60% of people said that they would only be able to cry to 1 to 5 people.
Also bang on Dunbar's number.
Yeah.
Yay. Awesome. That is really interesting also, because a lot of people have been saying, what about social media and our new interconnected world? So if Dunbar's number is the number of people that you can sustain a relationship with, then surely our more interconnected world means this number will have increased.
Yeah, he says not. He says that if it's about cognitive constraints and time constraints, then maybe it makes it a little bit easier to kind of reel in those people who are drifting off from your 150 into your 500. But by and large, the data doesn't seem to suggest that we have changed necessarily.
No, because there was actually a study done on Twitter that looked at Twitter interactions over 6 months. And again, the number of actually kind of consistent interactions was only around 150. So I reckon social media has made it maybe that we have more than 500 friends that we are like acquaintances, but we still can only maintain, like you said, because of time constraints, the 150. In fact, we actually asked how many people you were friends with on Facebook. So this is our way of trying to see the wider acquaintances. So Dunbar said it would be about 500 that you might have as acquaintances. What was that?
So the response was about 400 to 600. Now, so that's right in the middle, but this is there was a much wider spread on this. So there was actually, while we said that, only about 25% of people said 400 to 600, and a lot of people said less, and a lot of people said more.
That's interesting. There was, I think there was a study which looked at the number of Facebook friends people have and their tendency to be a bit sociopathic. And basically, the more friends you have, well, like those people had hundreds and hundreds, or thousands and thousands of friends.
So all of the people in our survey, the 9.76% of people who said they have more than 1,000 friends, maybe you have slightly sociopathic tendencies.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Judgment, but.
Well, another point that I came across in my reading was that for social networks to sort of be kept up to date, you need, or like for to maintain this relationship, you do need face-to-face shared experiences. And that, you know, knowing that you've both liked the same post or you've both watched the same YouTube clip is not the same. You don't laugh as loud when you're watching on your own. And that this seems to be crucial for maintaining those friendships, which maybe links back to the kind of grooming primates and why that's important. But then what they also said is, well, we haven't got a generation yet that's grown up with this kind of much more interconnected virtual world, that they're teenagers at the moment. And we do also know that the brain and its early time, it's very plastic. And so maybe if you're growing up in a world where there's less face-to-face interaction, that you will need it less, or I don't know whether that's going to change. Traditionally, there's been a kind of 60-40 split of you spend most of your time with the 50 closest and less of your time with the overall 150. And maybe social media might be changing that 60-40 split. Who knows? All to play for. Yeah, anyway, well, I got really excited about Dunbar's number. I thought it was cool. And how great that our survey kind of matched it. Yay! So we're coming to the end of the show. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And we'll be tweeting a link to an article written all about Mark's paper on the sexual equality if you want to read further. But for now, we've only got time for our last song. So what do you want to play out on?
I want to play out on Soon Come by Shy FX and Liam Bailey.